Awesome to welcome American University head coach Dwayne Simpkins to the basketball podcast. Simpkins has made a significant impact as the head coach of American, leading the program to new heights in the Patriot League. Over his tenure, he has compiled an impressive 38 and 29 record. In just his second year, Simpkins led the Eagles to a historic season, winning the 2024-25 Patriot League Championship and earning the program's first NCAA tournament appearance since 2014. American finished 22 and 13 overall and 13 and 5 in the Patriot League, matching the program's all-time record for league wins in a season. Simpkins joined American after 8 seasons on the coaching staff at George Mason, where he helped guide the Patriots to multiple program bests within the Atlantic 10. His coaching career also includes stints at UNC Greensboro, Townsend, and the high school level at St. Albans, Sidwell Friends, and Bishop O'Connell. A DMV basketball legend, Simpkins earned McDonald's High School All-America honors at Dematha Catholic under Hall of Fame coach Morgan Wooten. He was a three-time All-ACC honorable mention selection at the University of Maryland and helped lead the Terrapins to 3 NCAA tournament appearances, including 2 Sweet 16 runs.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Coach Simpkins, welcome to the basketball podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris, man. Long time fan, and I've listened to your very first podcast with my former head coach and great friend, Dave Paulson, I guess about 10, 11 years ago, something like that now. So pretty cool.
It feels like that. We're over 340 episodes or something. I don't know. I can't keep track either. But hey, awesome. In the meantime, you had an historic season at American and just an incredible season. I'm curious, have you processed that yet?
It's funny. No, not really. Literally just yesterday was going through my Twitter timeline, or X timeline, I should say, and came across some videos that our great people here in our sports information department posted, and I retweeted it and everything, but I didn't really watch it. And I literally just last night sat and watched some of the stuff, and it gave me chills, man. It just, damn, we won a championship. The way my mind works, man, I'm like on to the next thing. And there is no next thing right now. The next thing is not until July 1st when our freshmen get on campus and we're able to work with our guys. Just getting a chance, man, to decompress a little bit and soak it in a little bit, I think it's probably helpful.
It's helpful and it's necessary. And you already referenced it. We're not necessarily very good at that as coaches, because we're always moving on to the next thing. And great, we achieved it. And now we want to do the next thing. So maybe it's just shape for us first. You won the championship, you went to the NCAA tournament, great experience all around. And then where does your focus go right after that?
Quite honestly, man, we're going to be very young next year. We'd lose six seniors, five of them played quite a bit. One of them was a walk-on. So losing those guys, and we're bringing in 6 freshmen. They're talented. They will be longer, more athletic. We'll have pretty good depth just like we had this year, but we're going to lose a ton of experience. My mind has been focused on what are the things we need to do there's going to be a learning curve. How do we shorten that learning curve with these guys? It's been everything, man, from getting 4 or 5 games of theirs from high school and really watching them, cutting it up, showing our staff the things that they do well, the things that they're going to have to improve on. We know that they're talented, and we're going to have to change the way that we play a little bit from an offensive and defensive perspective. And it's identifying those things as soon as possible. And then I did something that I haven't done. I've only been a head coach, just completed my second year, but this is the first time that I've done this where I've actually called and had some extensive conversations with all of those freshmen's high school coaches and saying, hey, coach, now that the season's over, you've worked with these guys for 2, 3, 4 years. Give me everything, the good, the bad, the things that you feel that they really improved on, the things that in the back of your mind is a concern for you as they transition to college, whether it be the work ethic. I think all of them have great work ethics. Some kids, how are they in adverse situations when you've gotten on them 2 or 3 times and they're not playing well? Who shuts down? What are some of the triggers? And all those things are really important, man, in this day and age, because a lot of teams, no matter if you're older or younger, they're new teams in this day and age of transfer portal NIL. So the quicker that we can shorten that learning curve, that has been my sole focus right now.
I love that. That's a fascinating look at kind of that next step. And certainly that communication with the high school coaches is interesting as well. And I'm curious, you shared with me your four core values, which I want you to outline a little bit. But speaking of those new players coming into your program, how quickly are you trying to shape those core values for those players?
I'll be honest, because they're here, they've checked those boxes. We've done enough due diligence to identify whether those things are checked off. And I tell people all the time, it's not just the student athlete, it's their families as well. When we recruit a kid, and it's not just recruiting the player, it's looking in the stands and seeing how parents react when little Johnny gets taken out of the game or little Johnny's not playing well. How are they with the other parents? Because when we have them here in DC at American, it's a complete team effort. And it's not just the players, it's not just the staff, but it's those parents as well. There are going to be some tough times. And I want to be able to know that they, speaking of the very first core value, their character, is that character still going to be in play when things aren't going well? So high character kids, first and foremost, and their families, their support system is really important. Secondly, is work ethic. It's so funny to see kids nowadays on IG and X, they post videos of themselves working out in the summertime. I'm grinding, I'm putting time in. What does that work ethic look like in December, January, when you got those dog days, you get into conference play and you're doing the same stuff over and over again? Do you still have that level of the same work ethic level that you portrayed in the summertime when everything was cool? And then the third one for us is toughness. And it's not toughness just from a physical standpoint. It's also from the emotional and spiritual standpoint, where when things aren't going well and you're tired, do you still have that same work ethic? Do you still have the ability to move on to the next play? I love going out and recruiting kids and seeing them not have a good game, especially if I've identified that they're good players and they're a good fit for us. I want to see they picked up two fouls in the first quarter and they had to sit. I want to see that their shot's not falling. What other areas of the game can they have their fingerprints on it and still contribute? I think that's really important. And
Do
then
you feel
lastly,
mainly understanding those things helps you be able to connect with them better when you need to be solving some of those situations for them?
absolutely. If there's a young man, and everybody's different, but for me to be able to coach a young man, I have to see that there is a level of resilience in you, because you and I know, Chris, we play the game, we coach the game. There has never been a full season where everything is going well. It never happens. And we stress to our guys all the time in practice, like, we're preparing for our most adverse situations, whether it be we're down 4 points with 15 seconds to go, or we're on the road and we've lost two in a row. Those are the things. That's what gets my juices flowing, to be quite honest with you. I want to stress and prepare our guys for those situations. And if you're a player, no matter how talented you are, if you are the type of player that folds in those situations and can't bounce back, it's going to be very difficult for me to coach you.
It makes sense. And people that don't know, the Patriot League is you're dealing largely with your roster. You're not having as much roster turnover from the portal. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's starting to change a little bit. Our first, second, and third team all Patriot League players coming next year. There's one player returning. Obviously, you've had some that have transitioned due to graduation, and then you've also had some that have transitioned due to transfer. This is obviously, again, this is only my second year, but this wasn't the case a year ago. I'm assuming that this may continue to happen. We're going to have some players that are, could they play at a higher level? Yeah, they could. Are they going to have the same impact early? Probably not. And it's just a matter of time. I'm curious to see how it plays out in the next 2 or 3 years, where you now can have some quantitative data that shows specifically, hey, just because you are asked to play at a higher level and you're given some money does not mean that you're going to play and you're going to play at an efficient level. So I think that's something that's a reality that I think we're going to have to settle in with.
It leads me into the question, which is when you inherited your roster, you shared with me three different types of players that you had to account for in your coaching. And part of your success was being able to make these players productive in the way that you wanted to play and the culture you wanted to build. So if we could just go through those, let's maybe start with the first one where you had a point guard that was quick, but turned the ball over way too much. So talk to us about how did you deal with that? How did you help course correct that player?
Yeah, Elijah Stevens was a point guard that I inherited, lefty, 5'9", 5'10", from Waco, Texas, extremely quick. As a point guard, I would have hated playing against him. And when I got the job, I sat in, even before, I watched a ton of film. And I had a kind of an advantage too when I was at George Mason as an assistant. We played American, I was there for 8 years. I think we played American four times, maybe five. So I had known the personnel pretty good. I had the scout every time we played American, ironically. And this kid, you could just see it, man. He had certain things that were really good, like he could push tempo. We had to deprogram him and the rest of the team, quite honestly, because the previous staff, the previous way that they played was it was strictly Princeton style offense. They walked the ball up the court. My intention was to play much faster. We would grind you out in a half court if we needed to with sets and everything, but ideally we wanted to try to score in the first 7 seconds. So I knew that was going to be catered. That was going to be right up his alley. He was going to be able to do that. And when I watch his the clips of his turnovers, and he was turning the ball over at a 26% rate, which is extremely high for any player, but especially a point guard. And a lot of it was due to the fact that two things. One, he would fundamentally, we're really big on playing off 2 feet. He would jump in the air to find passes all the time. I don't mind for you to jump in the air to make a pass, but to jump in the air to find a pass was that's what he did all the time. And then secondly, I think that there were some times when he was in fourth gear, fifth gear, and the rest of the players he was playing with, they were in second or third because that's just how they played. And there was some turnovers that may have occurred where he had the right thought in mind, but according to how they were playing, it would result in a turnover. So with him, it was watching a ton of film, watch a ton of film on Jalen Brunson. I think the guys at Villanova, Jay Wright's done a tremendous job in the past with those guys. And we watched a ton of film on smaller players and how they took care of the basketball and how they managed the game. And it was frustrating as a point guard. You know how it should look and things like that. But I had to meet him in the middle. I had to play to his strengths, his ability to push the basketball, which was great for us, but also to be able to slow down and go from fifth gear to maybe second or third and be able to read the game better while playing off of 2 feet. And I think that helped him a lot. And he didn't shoot the ball well from three. We spent a ton of time working on his 3-point shot, and he second year, his first year together, he shot at a higher clip. He shot 34%. In his past year, he shot 35%. He was a sub 30% 3-point shooter coming into my time with him. So that was a big win for us.
Great insights in terms of how a coach can work with a player, change style of play, change emphasis, different things like that, and helps them succeed. And I know you had another player who was a four-man who led you in rebounding, but shot less than 20% from three. And talk to us about how you helped plug that player.
Yeah, Lincoln Ball, man, like the heart and soul of our team. He was a transfer from GW. He got here and his playing time was up and down. He was in the starting lineup, was out of the starting lineup. He was told not to shoot. So it was almost like PTSD with him when I first got him. It was like, I ideally want to have at least four guys on the court that can stretch the court, that can shoot it. And he was the odd man out. But I put the battery in his back, Chris, and I told him, hey, you're going to be a shooter. Like, we worked a ton on all of our guys shooting. And when I would see him hesitate, I would cuss him out. I would take him out and say, hey, no, your defender's feet are inside a 3-point line, shoot the basketball. But I know that in the back of his mind, it was like he was almost conditioned not to. And it got to the point, you know how it is as a coach, at a certain point in time, you've got to really do a self-evaluation and say, hey, what's working for our team and what's not. And he was not a good 3-point shooter for whatever reason. I think his mechanics were fine, but I think it was so much mental. And we just got to the point where we said, hey, early in the game, I don't care. And teams were playing this way in conference. They would like literally sit in the paint and it would disrupt the flow of our offense and our spacing. So I told him the first two or three times you're open, shoot it. I don't care what happens, shoot it. You might make a couple. Now it changes the complexion of how they want to guard you. But more times than not, he didn't make them. And what we had to focus on with him was like, how else can he impact the game? He was a tremendous tap back guy. He saved us in some games, man, where we would get a shot up and he wouldn't be able to get two hands on the ball, but he would gain us another possession by back tapping it. And we would get a dagger three and things like that. He was a tremendous connector. He really took care of the basketball. His assist to turnover ratio was almost 3-to-1. And we just valued his offensive rebounding ability and his ability to be a connector and dribble handoffs and zoom actions and uphill DHOs and stuff like that. And that helped us continue to flow into our offense and play. And he was an emotional leader for us, the most vocal. He worked his tail off. He played through injury. And what I had to do as a coach is anytime we saw that on film, I would highlight him and praise him so much in front of the other players so that they saw his value. They knew the things he didn't do well, but they knew that the pluses that he had that he brought to the table far outweighed the minuses.
Yeah, I love that. I love that highlighting his strengths, but also the challenges for a coach, because I know other coaches are in this situation where you see the possibilities, but for whatever reason, it just doesn't connect. That you see that he can shoot it, but he really can't shoot it in games. And that's a problem. And it's really hard as a coach, isn't it?
It is, man. Especially, I really pride myself on skill development. Going back to my days as a player, like I wasn't the fastest, I wasn't the most athletic, I wasn't the most prolific scorer, but I really valued the work that I put in the summertime and off season and just working my tail off. So I bring that to the table as a head coach. I almost feel like sometimes I failed him and failed our team because I couldn't get him over the hump. I think we had him for one more year, potentially. We could get him to instead of 19%, maybe give him a 31. But again, at some point in time, you've got to take a step back and say, hey, what's best for our team and what's going to help us win games?
And then maybe the gift that you had never had a five man that can shoot it, and you had one finally. So talk to us about how you adapted to coaching the five man that can shoot it.
Yeah, Matt Rogers for us, man, was tremendous. He was everything for us. It's a kid who shot in Patriot League play, shot 45%, 46% from three. He made the most threes in his career, made the most threes for us this year. And I had to, there was a big adjustment for me. I played with Joe Smith back in the day, was number one overall pick with Golden State. And he was an interior player. And some of the players that I played with that were really good big men in Europe, they were ball screen, they were roll, they could work in the post. And I had some idea of some things that we could do with him and picking and popping and getting him to empty side ball screens and things like that. But he helped me grow as a coach because year one, I identified that he could shoot the basketball and we ran some stuff for him, but things got slanted, for lack of a better term. I think he popped too much. And I wanted him to have the flexibility to be able to do that. But also, he was very good inside, too. And I think in my first year, I probably mismanaged him and allowing him to pop too much. And I think it hurt us in terms of picking up fouls and the other bigs in on the interior. So for me, as the growth that I had from year one to year two was, okay, we've got this family of plays that we have, and we have within that family, we've got these four, five, six plays that have two or three different options. All right, there are going to be certain things that we're going to define. Matt, the only thing you can do here is roll. So we had to clearly delineate to him and articulate to him those particular times we had to roll. And then I had to incorporate more things that were specific for him to pop. And it cleared it for him where he didn't have to guess what he could and couldn't do. These things were defined, but yet they were still simplistic in nature. And consequently, I think it made him much more efficient and it made us much more efficient as a team.
So I think about it this way in terms of decision making, which is my thing a little bit, but that by limiting your decision making, you're removing decision fatigue from him. So he understands what he should do in what situation. What I'm curious about, at least in practice, maybe it didn't evolve to the games yet, but was he getting to the point where he could figure it out more on his own because you initially limited it?
And he became a better basketball player because of it. Obviously, we have certain plays and everything, but he would come to me. It was great. Sometimes he and our point guard would come to us sometimes and say, hey, coach, even on the empty side, I can still dive and now I can get to the post. And he recognized, like, hey, this guy's got two fouls on him. I can get to the post now and maybe pick up a third. That's where you know that you're really starting to grow as a team and the individuals that you have. But yes, but I think by defining those roles specifically when he could pop or roll, it actually made him a better basketball player and he could just instinctively play.
Hey, coach, a brief timeout from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. How do you decide who your biggest impact players are? Traditional stats don't tell the whole story, which is why high-level pro and college teams rely on analytics systems like Hoopsalytics to make data-driven lineup decisions. Examining team stats when a player is on the floor tells a more compelling story. For example, you can use net points per possession to determine your best two-way players, as well as your offensive and defensive stars, or use the team rebounding percentage for each player to see who has the biggest impact on rebounding. The results may surprise you. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's HOOP
salytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your games for free.
Talk to us about your pace and space style, certainly with a high rebounding emphasis to fuel transition and the different things like that. Because as you said, you referred to the former program or the former coaches ran the Princeton system, and now you're trying to fuel this team up and get it going in transition. So can you talk to us about that process?
Yeah, we want to try to score in the first 7 seconds. We call it the first 7 seconds offense for us. And it's just that we're trying to score, whether it be a three, it could be a layup, it could be a dribbling three. It doesn't matter. Like if there's a quality shot, a shot that we value and that we work on every single day, we want to try to get that in the first 7 seconds. And you mentioned the Princeton offense, even though we still have some Princeton based things that we did. Matt Rogers, again, he was great at what we call the get, catch the ball at the top of the key and playing off dribble handoffs and have different actions and things like that. And we got to the point where even after the first 7 seconds, we could now flow right into our, we call play the game, utilizing him at the get position and everything. But that was, it took some time because those guys had to realize every single day in practice, yeah, we're going to run a lot. And it's not necessarily doing sprints, but like a lot of our drills, they're full court, whether it be team drills, 5-on-5, or whether it be individual things. Like if you're going to work on sprinting to the corner and catching and shooting a three, and you're going to do that in a game, you got to have the same type of pace when you do our individual breakdown stuff as well. And it's funny because our quote unquote pace of play, if you were to look at KenPom or whatever, it's not very high. It's actually pretty low. But what's very deceiving is the fact that if we are, your transition defense allows us to try to get a shot up and score in the first 7 seconds, we will. But after that, I'm really big on let's get that ball moving from one side of the court to the next and then get whatever it is that we're trying to get going into that game. The emphasis for this game very well could be, hey, we're going to post Matt 7 out of 10 times. On another game, they've got a 7-footer that blocks shots really well. Matt's going to probably shoot 10 threes this game. It varied, but it did slow our pace down on paper. But nonetheless, we're still going to attack in the first 7 seconds.
Well, I love that blended style. And talk to us a little bit more maybe about if we can't score in the first 7 seconds, then how are we flowing from there? You mentioned going side to side, but are these plays, are these things that are triggered conceptually? What are the ideas that happen if we don't score in the first 7 seconds?
Yeah, they're all conceptual. We're not going to bring the ball out unless we want to get a quick hitter or we'll go at something. We're not going to call a set play. But also, it is conceptual, and a lot of it is Princeton based. The one thing we never really could get Matt over the hump with was, all right, he's at the dunker spot and there's some action that's going on away from him, whether it be a ghost ball screen, whatever the case may be. He never could get a good sense of, hey, we're stuck in the mud. I've got to fly up to a get so that we can initiate some action to the other side. So what we did with him was we said, hey, Matt, you stay at the dunker opposite until there's a dribble handoff. Dribble handoff automatically signifies for you to fly up to the get. And now we've got, you're in the middle and we've got two guys on each side and you can play either way. And we would have different actions. Obviously, you got your zoom action. We would have different variations of zoom where we may top cut the bottom guy who's in the corner. And now it's a two-man game with you and the point guard, whatever the case may be. So ideally, that is our quote-unquote play the game when things don't work out in the first 7 seconds. Again, as opposed to bringing the ball out and calling a set play, that helps us flow into our play the game.
That's excellent. That's a great example of a trigger there, that dribble handoff that triggers the get. Yes. Just a simple concept and a great way to be able to say, okay, we're out of flow and now we're trying to create an advantage a little bit more out of neutral or however you call it. So just great stuff. Coach, I know we'll go here a few times with different things, but one of the things I read about you is that you've been preparing for this head coaching position, as all good assistants do, for a very long time in terms of at least role-playing it or taking the notes or doing the things. And I understand you kept a detailed notebook planning your coaching career, including values and strategies. And can you just talk to us about that and shape that a little bit for us, what it looked like?
Yeah. That started, man, when I was at Towson. I was my first job in college was as director of operations. And my wife, she's a therapist by trade. And she said, you got to document some of the things that you're doing and it'll help you grow. And at first I was like, oh, I don't have time for that and everything. But I would spend time. I wouldn't spend time in writing 3 or 4 pages at a time. It could be something on that particular day that resonated. And it made me say, hey, if I were the head coach, what would I do differently? It could be anything from when I was operations guy at Towson. During the winter break, we would have to actually move out of the dorms and we would move on to the hotel on campus. And that brought along so many different obstacles, whether it be with food, whether it be with guys not doing what they're supposed to do, so to speak, away from the team. And I would just make mental note. I would make notes on how I would do that differently. And I did that to my next stop at UNC Greensboro. There were certain things, and it could be everything. It could be anything philosophical. It could be a X's and O's thing. It'd be a baseline out of bounds play that I said, man, that's really good, and that's going to stand the test of time. I put it in a notebook. And Chris, I'll be honest, there were some things that I jotted down that I said, I do not want to do that. That's not me as a coach and as a person. And so it was great, man. I just had an accumulation of things, not just X's and O's, but as importantly, some of the things that are off the court, the management of your staff. I remember feeling not the most valued sometimes because I was new to the staff. And all right, now if I'm a head coach and I have changeover on my staff, how can I make that new person feel a part of everything? It could be as simple, Chris. I'll leave you with this one. This is really big. My wife felt that when we moved to Towson and she got a basket, what do you call those things, a fruit basket or something like that from Pat Scary's wife, Christy. And it was like, my wife loved that. And she herself said, hey, if you're a head coach, whenever we have somebody new on staff, I need their email address, I need their address. I'm going to drop them some stuff in the mail. And they got any kids, we'll make sure we get them gear. And sure enough, like she did that last year, our first year here. And the connection, man, that you will make with not only the staff members, but their families is priceless, man. And now I feel like everybody's on the same page and everybody wants to run through a brick wall for you.
I love that. Those small things do make a big difference. And just again, do you still go through those notes? Do you still go back a little bit sometimes?
From time to time, I've adapted a little bit now due to technology. I use my notes on my phone, and I can just browse through. And those things are so cool, man. I'll sit in the bed and I'm watching the Nuggets play a couple of weeks ago, and there was an ATO play, and I could just pull it out. I could screenshot it and put it in my notes and label it and everything. So I use my notes now.
Love it. Love it. Modern technology helps that. And I do the same, but I still have all those old notes too. You referenced, particularly in recruiting, getting to know the families, engaging the families. But I know a big part that you shared with me is this concept of intentionally engaging with families throughout the season. Can you outline? Because I think this is such a huge topic for coaches at all level, from AAU, high school, college, et cetera, to be able to engage with the families.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that the young men that we work with nowadays they're different, right? And every generation is different. I don't like it when I hear coaches say the kids are softer, they're not as smart as we were and everything. No, there were a number of players that I played with. They were good athletes. They were not the brightest. They were not the greatest tacticians. And the biggest thing with now, I'm a parent. I just sent my son off to college 2 years ago, and I know the feeling that I want to have, knowing that my son is going to be taken care of by those people that are around him. And that pretty much helped me lay out getting connections with the incoming players. And like I shared this with you last year. This is the first time I did it. I sent a text to all of our players' parents. And what do we need to know about little Johnny? I need you guys to let me know throughout the course of the season. Is Johnny's dog, did it just die? Is his grandmom who lives with him, who helped raise him, she's sick? Hey, you guys are having some issues that are going to impact how he is performing in the classroom and on the court. I need to know all of these things, and don't be bashful. Don't think that, hey, we can't divulge these things to coach, because I am the closest thing to a parent that your son has. So anything that you can share with me, hey, he takes ADHD medicine and sometimes he chooses not to, and it affects his sleeping. I need to know all those things to help me to be the best version of a parent in your place for your child. And it's going to help us win basketball games, conversely. So things like that are really important. The intentionality with when those guys are here on campus, I hear coaches talk about, yeah, I touch base with my guys every day, and guys do different things. For me, FaceTime is really important. It's not enough to shoot a text. And a text is cool. I'll shoot a text and, hey, man, great practice today, whatever. I'll shoot him a clip from watching film of practice and, hey, you did a good job on this. We talked about this. You're getting better at that. Or, hey, you need to improve on that. But sometimes just to hit them up at 10 o'clock when I know they're watching a game with the teammates, say, hey, man, like, what's going on? Let me see everybody's faces, that type of thing. And that develops a deeper connection so that when things aren't going well and I'm on your ass, but at the end of the day, that I love you.
Such great examples of engaging with the parents. And obviously, you're getting into a little bit engaging with the players, which is a common question because we all say relationships are important. But what does that practically look like? And you just gave the example of texting them clips, of FaceTiming them so that you can see their face, they can see your face. Are there some other things that you can share in that way that you've done to be able to help engage with your players?
We all watch film with our guys. I think it's important to understand that when you do watch film, we watch a lot of film. Watching film with our team versus watching film with someone individually is different. It's different. Certain guys are going to open up and ask questions, great questions that they won't ask in front of their teammates for whatever reason. And then as a head coach, I don't like it when I hear coaches, people say, hey, he's got to have a better relationship with the assistant coaches than he is with the head coach because the head coach is busy and everything. It's like, no, that's my job. I want to be just as much as Jackie Manuel on our staff, or Nate Bollinger or Isaiah Tate on our staff have connections with our players. I want to make sure I have those connections as well. It's going to be different. Recognize it's not going to be the exact same, but watching film, man, I think is really important. And anytime we're able to, if there is something that's going on, whether it be a tragedy within the family, whether it be not doing well on an exam, that's the perfect time to actually make the connection and sit down and talk. And it doesn't have to be about basketball. So just keeping your ear to the ground and knowing when those times do come up and really pouncing on them at the most opportune time.
When you gave parents an opportunity to be able to communicate with you about certain things, I imagine they enjoyed that.
Yeah, it caught him off guard because I was transparent and I said everything, a girlfriend that maybe you don't like, how things are going. And because this is the thing, whether they realize it or not, my relationships that I developed with their sons, there are things that they have shared with me that the parents might not even know. So to be able to have that connection is really important. And for them to know that my intention is to do that. It's surprising, but at the same time, I got individual texts from every single one of them saying how much they appreciated it, and they would make sure that I stay in the loop of anything that's going on.
Yeah, it's very cool to hear that. And I know another thing you do practice, I think pre-practice or before film, you indicated, but the words of wisdom. It's one of the things that you played for Morgan Wootten, so it's definitely direct from the source. But reading so many of his things and learning so much from him over the years, I know that was one of the staples that I took away from him as well. So maybe can you shape that for our audience? Just let us know the inspiration behind that and maybe some of the examples of what you might do.
Yeah, Coach Wooten, man, was for me the most impactful coach that I've had. And not because he was such a good coach on the court, but because of the teaching life lessons that he poured into me and all of my teammates that I still utilize to this day. Be quick, but don't be in a hurry. Every single day, Coach Wooten would hit us with it could be a quote, it could be a paragraph, it could be a poem. And I'm not as good at it as he is. But I do utilize technology now and video. We could be going through a tough time, for instance, for whatever reason, down the stretch. We had a successful year, but down the stretch, we lost a couple games. I think we lost two of our last four or something like that going into conference play. And we were shooting abysmally. We were shooting like maybe 30% from three. And I'm watching film and I'm like, I would take every single one of these threes, I would not change a thing. And so just to be able to go in there, going into the latter part of the conference play, and we sat and we watched every single one of those clips. And I said, Coach, guys, you like this shot? Yeah. Showed another one. Would you like we take this one? Yeah. And so now they in their mind are like, hey, we're not doing anything. We're not gonna do anything different. We're not doing anything wrong. And I would go into I got a list of quotes from Coach Wooten, and I pull one up to put a cherry on top of it. Those type of things. I could go down a list of some of the things that he has. I'm not as good as him, man. He was like the best teacher, the absolute best teacher.
He was a tremendous speaker as well and a tremendous sharer with coaches. And I know we've all benefited from him and very cool to hear some of those experiences with him. And you referred to that kind of end of season stretch. And again, where it's not the ideal time to go through some poor stretches, but it's realities that happen. So talk to us maybe aside from what you just mentioned, what are some other things that you did to get your team prepared to play so well at the end of the season?
I think what helped us win, quite honestly, down the stretch, man, we became a player-led team. I had been imploring our guys year one, I knew it wasn't going to happen year one. Throughout year two was, hey man, you guys got to coach each other. It's not enough for us to be the ones that's telling you something's not good enough in practice. The energy is not good enough. And even before that stretch that we had, the bad stretch, like I could see some semblances of us being a player-led team. I remember at halftime, before I go in, I could hear the voices that were going on in the locker room, the guys talking to each other. There was some yelling and some hollering, but it was like when I walked in there, I could see that everybody was on the same page and we were ready to go to address whatever issues we had and go out and play in the second half. But when I heard the voices of our players amongst each other, I felt we were now a player-led team. And it's so funny, I took our seniors out for lunch last week, and I was bringing up, hey man, what's some of your favorite memories and this and that? And we talked about our championship game going against Navy. And I said it, I brought up the Navy game, and they all looked at me and they said, Coach, we weren't losing that game. And I was like, what do you mean? They said, we weren't losing that game, Coach. Like we had already in our minds, we had talked to people, we were not losing that game. And it was so cool to see, man, because once you get your team to that point where you feel like you've earned the right to win a basketball game, you've worked hard, you put all the blood, sweat, and tears in, and you genuinely can look yourself in the mirror and say, we deserve to win, man, you're going to have a lot of success.
You've been to the NCAA tournament as a player, obviously. So I'm curious, this many years later, what was that experience like as a coach, as a head coach?
It was surreal. It was like it took for me on Selection Sunday to really sit back and say, I have not been to the NCAA tournament since 1996 as a player. And I've been around some really good coaches. Pat Scarry at Towson is a tremendous coach. Dave Paulson is a tremendous coach. Wes Miller is a tremendous coach. Kim English. And to know that through all those experiences, I had not touched the NCAA tournament. One, I felt really blessed. And it was so funny. I told all of our guys in the lead up to this season, I mentioned it throughout the season and said, hey, man, fellas, the reason why we're working so hard is to get to the NCAA tournament. And I said, let me tell you, the lights are brighter, the seats are plusher, the carpet that you walk on is softer, everything is like at a higher level. And to be able to get to that point, and the guys joked me after our first, I think we had a shoot around or something. And then they were like, Coach, you're not lying. The seats are softer and the lights are brighter and everything. To be able to do that, man, was just awesome. And again, it took me that until that point to realize that I had not been in since 1996, which is crazy.
That's amazing. What an experience that must have been. Coaches know who listen to the podcast like yourself. They sometimes text coaches in your league to get some insights of good questions. And one of them that came back was this concept of you guys taking away the 3-point line, that they thought you guys did an outstanding job this year doing that. So just curious, maybe if you can shape that a little bit for us.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we addressed in the offseason. We sat down, we looked at all of our analytics and things we did well, things we didn't do well. And defensively, we were not a good team. The team that I inherited, they were not a good team. And you could tell that there were a bunch of habits that they were not going to be fixed in a year. We went from being more of a kind of a pack line-ish team year one to saying, you know what, I'm more comfortable teaching being in denials. And I just think we made the game so easy for teams, especially in our league. Man, we have a number of teams that are well coached and they can shoot the basketball from three. And we gave up a ton of threes and they made them at a high clip. Chris, we were giving up shots from the corner at 38.9% a game. Like that is absurd. And so we wanted to make things difficult. If you wanted to reverse the ball or get into the ball to the wing, we wanted to push those catches out. We wanted you to start your defense out much further than you were probably used to doing it. And we had some bad habits. Like we helped off of corners way too much. We really emphasized making sure that we stunted at the ball. We call it stick and stay. You stick at the ball and you stay home and know that the backside from underneath the basket, that's where your rotations are coming. So we just got much better at really emphasizing those things and working on them on a single every single day. And I think once the guys could start to see that we had success with it, it kind of ramped up and took a life of its own a little bit. We still got a ways to go now.
Of course, we're never there. I know that, coach. We're the same. We're all the same as coaches, that there's always can be better or always can be something that we can improve on. Just sticking on that a little bit then, when you go into the season then and you have this mindset of we're going to do this better, what is the first step? Is it selling the players on why we need to do this better? Or are you showing them something first to be able to highlight, hey, this needs to improve for us to win.
Yeah, both last year, going into last year, I had some sheets and I blew them up and it had our numbers, our defensive numbers, and it was atrocious. And they don't look at KenPom like I do. And I say, hey, red means bad. There's a lot of red. The only thing we did well from a defensive standpoint, we were like top 60 in the country in defensive rebounding percentage. But outside of that, we gave up a ton of threes. We fouled. The 2-point percentage was high. So, fellas, we'll win some games because we're a better offensive team and everything. We won't win a championship if our defense isn't better. And so it started with that. And then we also would watch film of those specific things that led to us being such a bad defensive team. The corner threes we talked about, allowing people to reverse the basketball and just straight line drives. So from there, it was these are the things that we need to work on. And we're not going to move on to the next thing until we see that we're having progress. And the first thing was guarding the basketball. Like, we spent quite a bit of time last July when our guys got back of just simply guarding the basketball. Whether you're a five man, Matt Rogers, like, you're not always going to guard a five. I want you to be able to sit down and guard a guard and at least make sure that he doesn't go straight line drive. He's got to take a dribble or two outside the basket in order to get to where he's trying to get to. So it started with that. And then the next layer was, okay, where is our help coming from? What does the help look like? Those type of things.
Curious, I guess you mentioned player development. So, as a former high-level player, having gone through a Morgan Wootten type development system, and then being exposed to so many coaches through your time, how much has your player development philosophy shifted or changed since your time as a player?
The work is still the work. You still got to put the time into it. Now, the quality of work and the thought process behind it has changed. It's more intentional, I would say. I tell our guys all the time, and if you call or text me and say that you're home and you were in the gym for 2.5 hours working on your game, I'm going to say, you're either lying or I'll tell you this is the dumbest thing that you should do. Lay out a plan, the shots that we value in our offense. Do those things at game speed. Trust me, between that and shooting some free throws and your ball handling, that workout should be 55 minutes, 60 tops if you're doing it at game speed. And the other thing, we talk about the intentionality. Like, we have certain shots that we're going to get in our offense off of certain movements. It could be lifting from the corner to the wing on a shake action for ball screen. It could be pitching ahead for a pitch ahead three. Those are the shots that we value. Simulate those same movements into those game shots, getting a shot off in 0.5 seconds. That's where I think I've grown in terms of skill development, is making sure that identifying those specific shots that our players are going to get within our offense and making sure we rep them at game speed.
And you also referenced a little bit that the role of your assistants and the role of them in the player development process. Can you take us a little bit through how you manage your staff in terms of player development responsibilities and the different types of things that you expect from your assistants?
I want them to be fully engaged when it comes to skill development stuff. We have an offensive defensive coordinator and we have a defensive rebounding coordinator, Jackie Manuel, who's been tremendous. Jackie played at Carolina. We come from the same cloth almost. Dean Smith and Roy Williams, very much like Morgan Wootten from a basketball standpoint. He handles our defense and he was one of the best defensive players I've ever seen. And he has grown tremendously from year one to year two. And I think that's one of the reasons why our defense has grown. But outside of defense, he also works with our bigs. Our defensive coordinator, Ike Tate, he also works with our bigs and our guards. He freelances, goes both ways. Nate Bollinger, who's on our staff, who's our offensive coordinator, he and I tag team offense. He knows specifically the movements and shots that our guards are going to get. So he's working with the guards. And we'll spend 18 to 19 minutes every single day on guards and bigs. We'll split them up. And going into that particular game, once we're in season, we know that there are going to be certain things that our bigs are going to have to do. There are going to be certain things our guards going to be able to do to counter what the defense is going to do that game. But for instance, the bigs may we know that this team's going to try to ice. Well, we're going to short roll a lot. And so we're working on our big short rolling and spraying to the corner for three. Short roll to a little push out from 10 or 12 feet. Our guards are going to have to, on the other end, they're going to have to work on utilizing coming off the ball screen, inside hand, pocket pass, and maybe sprint to three, make a combination. After 8 or 9 minutes, we'll bring everybody together And now it's like we're combination work. So everything that you did on each individual side, now we're going to do them against some dummy defenders. And now it's live. We may do short-sided games where 3-on-3 or 4-on-4 and 8 seconds on a shot clock or what have you, so that those guys are repping that specific action. So everybody's hand is involved in it. We'll talk about these things leading up to practice of, hey, this is what I want us to be doing, working on both ends, and then this is how we're going to come together and do our combo work. And those guys are great, man. Like I told them from day one, there's no such thing as a bad question. I don't want you to just take what I say and say, hey, that's what we're going to do. So these guys, they challenge me on a daily basis. Coach, I don't agree with that. Why? Let's talk it out. And I may say, you know what? I still feel strong about it. Like, this is what we're going to do. Like, all right, coach. All right, cool. And we'll go out. We're a united front. And there's some days I'm sitting like, damn, I didn't think about that. We got to change that. So again, I'm all about growth, not only for our players, man, but our coaches. All of our coaches are going to be head coaches at some point in time. It's just a matter of when. And I want to help them in that development, and not allowing them to have a voice in that will impede their progress. And that's one of the things I didn't like as an assistant coach.
Very cool inside look at how you manage your program with your staff and player development. And you referenced them wanting to be head coaches. So you're pretty new to your head coaching life, a few years in, but was a tremendous longtime assistant. And there's many out there like you. So I'm curious now, in reflecting back on your time as an assistant transitioning to a head coach, what was something that you thought was going to be more important and wasn't? And maybe in reverse, what was something that is more important than you didn't realize, maybe?
Man, that's a great question, Chris. I think, man, managing this success when it did come, I felt like I was being pulled in a number of different directions, whether it be the local media wanting to come around a lot more and interviews, what have you. And I haven't had a ton of experience with fundraising and everything. And now it's fundraising because, yeah, we don't have the biggest budget. I want to get our guys more sweatsuits. I want to get more stuff for our athletic trainers. And so I've got to be intentional about setting the time aside to do those things and meet with people and try to raise money. I did not have as much experience with that. I knew that was a part of it, but I did not know once you had the success of, okay, now we got to try to build on that success and momentum. And that's exactly where I am right now. What was the other question you had? That
Just
was
maybe
pretty
what
cool.
was something that maybe you, I guess, were thinking was going to be really important and wasn't as important as you thought, maybe in terms of being a head coach.
Probably the offensive stuff. I've always looked at myself as like an offensive coach and realizing that, hey, man, put your players in the best position as possible. And you got to really focus on this defensive stuff because at the end of the day, I know I mentioned it, like the offense, this is going to win some games, but defense is what's going to help win championships. And the other thing I think I failed to mention this one, I think the close games, we had 9 games that we lost by a total of 33 points my first year. And Chris, I lost so much sleep that summer looking at games that I felt that I lost us. We played Georgetown early in the season, and I think it's Coach Cooley's second or third game, and we're playing them at their place. And but we're up, but we're controlling the game for the most part. And Jaden Epps is going crazy down the stretch. I mean, we're up 8 to 10 points with 3 minutes to go. And at the time, we had what we call our 55 sideline press. It's a 1-2-1-1, but it's just tilted to the side. We did it at Maryland, and we'll try to trap the basketball and everything. And we had some experience with it. We worked on it, not as much as we probably needed to. And it's a 3-point game with whatever 7 seconds to go. And because I did not tell our guy on the ball to angle himself in a way where he's taking away the corner three, he doesn't do it because I don't instruct him. We give up a corner three, game goes into overtime, we lose. That's on me. There were a number of games that I could reflect back on. I would watch in the summertime and watch them 2 or 3 times, man. Like, that's on me. I got to get better at that. And until you're in that position, you just don't know. It's like being a parent. Like, you can read the books and everything, but until that time where there's a timeout and there's 10 seconds on the clock and the clipboard's in your hand, you just got to go through that. And I was blessed to go through it. It hurt, but it made me a better coach. It made us a better team. And this year, I think we had 11 games where that were determined by 6 points or less, and we won 9 of them. So we flipped the script on it. But like, I was not completely prepared for that.
Well, that's such a great answer, all those. And we can all relate to that one, coach, because we're all coaches listening to this. But fans, media, administrators, they sometimes think we're supposed to just know all the answers. But there's nothing like experience when it comes to coaching, is there?
Yeah, I would tell them to turn it on yourself as a parent. Like, I'm sure you can go back and say, damn, I probably screwed that up. My kid's still alive, but I did not handle that well. It's the same thing.
That's a great answer. Absolutely. Many coaches will be doing that over the next little while. And coach, just as we wrap up, this has been tremendous and that's also awesome to talk to you, but just talk to us again how special it was to be able to help revitalize American University. And I know you love that area as well. You have so many roots in that area. So just a special experience for you, I imagine.
It is. It is. And you mentioned I had been an assistant coach for a long time. And just like a lot of assistant coaches out there, you're like, hey, I'm working hard, man. When is my opportunity going to come? And in my mind, when I felt like it was going to come at some point in time. And I prepared my wife because she's from the DC area as well. And said, hey, understand this job may take us to Ohio or there's certain places I'm not going to go. It just don't make sense. But I'm like, we'll be along up and down the Eastern Seaboard or something like that. And God has a plan. And if you had told me 5, 6 years ago, hey, you're not going to get a head coaching job for another 5 or 6 years, but it's going to be here in DC. I probably would have signed up for it. I would not have imagined this is going to happen. It's an awesome opportunity, man. And to do it at home in front of family and friends, there's so many people that I'm cool with, that I'm close with, that have never been to American University up until this past March to see games. And then to do it, man, like any institution that you as a head coach are a part of and you're running the athletic, you're running the basketball program in the athletic department. To be an ambassador of a place, to be able to bring value, to be able to bring recognition, it helps. You know, this is a business on a college campus. So if this is going to help applications, if this is going to help enrollment, if this is going to help put heads in the bed so that it helps the bottom line for the university, like that is part of my job that I take very seriously. And to be able to play a small role in that this year, man, was awesome. And I want to do it again. I want to win one or two games so that people can see an American jersey on a Thursday night. The millions of people are watching and people say, hey, man, what's this American University? Oh, it's in DC. Oh, man, they got a hell of a political science program. They got the business school is one of the best in the country. That's what my job is. And aside from winning basketball games, like this is something I take very seriously.
Incredible perspective. And thank you for sharing that and everything else that you shared with us, Coach. We're fired up to watch American University play basketball next year, even more now.
Oh, Chris, man, I really appreciate it. And man, again, thank you for all that you do, man. I got an hour drive into work every day. So I'm listening to you. I'm listening to the stuff that you pump out, man. And the guests that you've had is you're a tremendous resource. And thank you for all that you do for the game, man, and continue to do great work.